well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. Hope you had a happy Independence Day, celebrating America's 250th birthday. I have been off for the past couple of days, but I'm glad to be back with you. And I'm glad to share some of the conversation that I had with ATF Director Robert Sakata and ATF Chief Counsel Robert Leiter in Washington, D.C. recently. I'm going to be sharing clips of this interview over the next couple of days. And I'm going to set it up so that I'll set up the question. You'll hear the response. Just for technical limitations, I'm off mic during this interview, so it's just easier to set it up that way. But it was a great conversation. And really, you know, this is the second time that I've had the opportunity to interview Robert Sakata. I'm impressed with his candor. You know, typically, I wouldn't say typically, but sometimes you talk to public officials and they're very good at giving lengthy but not necessarily substantive answers. That's not the case with either Robert Sakata or Robert Leiter, by the way. The first time I had the opportunity to meet Mr. Leiter, and again, very impressed with what he is trying to do in terms of revamping the regs and the rules that the ATF has put in place, particularly over the past few years under the Biden administration. And that was where we kind of started the conversation. What was and what is the goal when the ATF introduces these rules? We have heard from gun control groups. We've heard from outfits like the New York Times, that and the Trace, that you know, the ATF is now just carrying water for the gun industry, which I think is a little bit of projection on their part, because for during the entirety of the Biden administration, I think the ATF was carrying water for the gun control lobby, and now I think that has come to an end. So what is the rationale for revising some of these rules, repealing some of the rules that were put in place under the Biden administration? I posed that question to Chief Counsel Robert Leiter. Here's what he had to say.
We wanted to carry out the president's agenda as he expressed it in his Second Amendment executive order. So the goal was to look through the regulations to find out the regulations that imposed unnecessary burdens on law-abiding citizens and to remove those regulations and to keep the regulatory space balanced so that regulations that are truly necessary for public safety continue on, but regulations that impose gratuitous burdens or burdens that are not authorized by law are removed. And we faced a situation where a lot of the ATF regulations have not been substantially overhauled since the 1990s. And businesses have changed quite a bit in the intervening 30 years. And so as we went through the rule book, we were looking through the categories that we're now listing on our webpage. We're looking for regulations that we can modernize. Businesses done differently in 2026 compared to when the last major revisions happened around the implementation of the Brady Act. We look to clarify things that were perennial questions. What's a straw purchase? That question is very basic to the everyday operation of a licensed dealer. And yet what a straw purchase is was always a confused concept. And it was confused because ATF alternated between buying for a prohibited person and buying for somebody who isn't the actual purchaser, whether or not he's prohibited. And the forms were confusing. The form said, are you the actual transferee slash buyer of the firearm? And then it would warn, you're not the actual transferee if you're buying on behalf of another person. And yet if you went to the instructions, you would realize, well, if it's a gift, you can buy for somebody else, but if it's not a gift, if somebody else is the real purchaser, then you can. But the form didn't say that. The form was confusing. And so we were looking at ways that we could clarify concepts that were used. And then we looked at the forms themselves and we asked. The Biden administration went through this period of quote-unquote zero tolerance where it was going to revoke dealers for certain regulatory violations. And we looked at what the nature of the regulatory violations was. And a lot of the violations weren't as advertised. So a lot of the violations, a lot of the purported zero tolerance enforcement would be failing to run a background check. But if you looked at a majority of the violations, they were not licensees who said, oh, I'm not going to comply with the Brady Act. I'm just not going to run any background checks. They were much more technical than that. So they were things like not doing a second background check on a transfer that went on day 31, because under the current rules, the background checks are valid for 30 days. And so if the gun was transferred on day 31, that would be counted as failure to run a background check. Where people get confused over which permits qualify as valid alternatives to the background check. So you can have a permit that is a valid NICS alternative, but it's only a valid NICS alternative in the state where the transfer is taking place. And so when we went to revise the 4473, we tried to clarify points of confusion. So we identify the types of permissible transactions, whether it's a purchase or a gift. We looked at the background check issue. We said, do we really need background checks to be valid only 30 days? And in looking at our data, we didn't think there would be any adverse public safety harm by making them valid for 2 calendar months. So now you don't need to calculate, is this a 28-day month, a 30-day month, a 31-day month? You can just say, on March 4th, I initiated the sale and got the background check back, and that background check is valid to May 4th. So it's much harder to commit that kind of technical violation. We added a checklist for the permits so that the dealer can check off whether the permit is a valid alternative to the Brady Act. So we were looking at trying to find ways to make it easier to comply with the regulations, to get rid of regulations that were unnecessary and confusing and that could be weaponized through zero tolerance enforcement, not to regulate the industry in good faith, but to shut down parts of the industry, to use those regulatory violations as a pretext just because people want to enact further gun control by reducing the number of dealers.
So I posed a similar question to ATF Director Robert Sakata after Mr. Leiter concluded his comments there. Going back to this idea that the ATF is now too buddy-buddy with the firearms industry, that they're cozying up to gun makers. And the question I posed to Robert Sakata was, should the ATF have an adversarial relationship with the firearms industry? Joe Biden, when he was running for president, famously called the firearms industry the enemy. And I think that's exactly how he treated the industry during his term in office. So is that what the ATF should be doing in terms of its approach to the industry that it regulates? Should it see it as an adversary, and should it take an adversarial view and treatment towards the industry that it regulates?
No, actually to the contrary. And I say that to you from my time as an agent, which I think was the best time I had in my career, is because I work with the folks in the industry. Not every business in the country that I've interacted with, but in the areas that I was assigned to conduct criminal investigations, more often than not, the industry would be reaching out to ATF about suspicious activity. And in particular, some of it was very overt, some of it wasn't. And, again, they wanted to make sure that the folks that were in that industry were doing the right thing, because many of these were family businesses, people that invested everything they had in there to try and make something for themselves that they were proud of, something they could pass on to their children. And ultimately, they were not looking to scam and conduct illegal transactions where they would put themselves in criminal jeopardy and lose a lifetime of investment. They also hated seeing when a gun was used in a massive, in a violent crime or a mass shooting, because they knew that in turn there was going to be a quick response to say, okay, more regulations, more laws, and the industry needs to be held accountable for this, when the industry was not responsible for the crime, the horrible crime. And I'm not going to minimize the crimes. The crimes are horrible, right? Violence is violence, whether it's a firearm, a knife, or a blunt instrument. It's horrible to see these things happen to American people. But you're right. There is definitely a there's a effort to demonize the industry as being responsible for violent crime. And again, I have no issue attributing that to a FFL that's actually involved in a criminal conspiracy. No problem. And I have no problem seeing them prosecuted to the full extent of the law. But I do have a problem when there is a clear motivation to not hold criminals accountable who use firearms illegally. And again, I can say this strongly. It was the clearest indicator to us came from the Department of Justice. There was a memorandum that came out from the Attorney General at the time, and the Attorney General was instructing all U.S. attorneys, thereby all of us who work for the U.S. attorneys in our respective areas of responsibility, not to charge anyone with a crime that has a minimum mandatory sentence attached to that statute. And those particular statutes as it relates to firearms offenses were some of the most effective statutes used back in the 90s when we went through some of our worst period of violent crime in the country to send the message to the people that were the most violent offenders that if you choose to live this life, you're going to be spending the next 20 to 35 years in prison. And it worked. And the same tools were taken away from us at the time when we were saying that guns are responsible for violent crime. And again, in my perspective, you can't have one and not the other. You can't blame a firearm that was used in a crime by a criminal and then not want to hold the criminal accountable. So for me, our recipe is not favoring the industry in the sense of turning a blind eye to something that's illegal or outside of the regulations, but an administrative error is an administrative error, just like I make or my employees make. We don't fire people because they make some mistakes, especially if they learn from those mistakes and they don't repeat those same mistakes and there's not a malicious effort to do that. We're supposed to work with the industry to bring them into compliance, and that's what we're doing. And again, there are some folks that are just not good business people, and they have a hard time in this industry. And I think we've discussed this before, where every year we see somewhere in the area of 6,000 to 9,000 FFLs go in and out of business because it's not easy. This is not an industry that you're going to make a ton of money in particular, frankly, in a Republican administration, because there isn't as much of a push because people are not stressed that their rights are going to be taken away from them to own firearms, other than some states that we're seeing some changes in their state laws that are concerning people. So we've seen a huge push on our system for transfers and for background checks, et cetera. So again, I am not apologizing to anyone for being fair and treating industry members as a partner to us. When I say partner, it's not a fiduciary. This is not ATF and the industry sharing any financial partnership here. This is a partner that we depend on, as I do the federal explosives licensees, to give us a first warning if they see something that's going on that could be a national security threat with an explosive or a firearm. So I'm very proud of that relationship that we have. And I also have no problem holding an FFL that crosses that line criminally accountable when necessary. And I think the other FFLs want us to do that when it's necessary as well.
My thanks to both Director Sakata and Chief Counsel Leiter for speaking with me. Again, we're going to have more of the conversation on tomorrow's Bear in Arms Cam and Company, so be sure to check that out as well. Before we get to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report, we should talk about this for just a second, as my rooster decides to chime in there. From city streets to mountain trails, your gear should go wherever life takes you, even to ATF headquarters. That's why at Modern Rugged Leather, every bag is handcrafted from premium, responsibly sourced leather. It's designed to look sharp, last long, and tell a story of its own. My rooster loves my Modern Rugged bag. Which, by the way, I will say this is a pretty good rooster defense tool as well. You can swing this at a rooster if it's ever coming at you, and they tend to back off. Every stitch, every buckle, every strap reflecting timeless craftsmanship, and it's backed by a lifetime warranty, because quality shouldn't quit when the adventure begins, with or without a rooster around. Man, he loves to hear himself talk. So whether it is the boardroom or the back roads, Modern Rugged Leather helps you carry confidence every step of the way. Now, right now, Modern Rugged Leather is getting ready to unveil their brand new website. If you go to modernrugged.com, you can sign up to get the latest details, brand new products coming out. Very excited to see what they have to offer. Make sure you go to modernrugged.com and sign up for the latest news on the full collection when it launches. That's, again, modernrugged.com. All right, on to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report with a little rooster commentary as well. All right, we will start here with a sad and tragic incident out of the Seattle, Washington area. Here's the headline. Family wants justice after 19-year-old killed in 4th of July hit and run. The driver in question, the suspect, with a lengthy criminal history, 17 felony convictions in Washington State since 1989, and yet was still out on the streets. According to Fox 13, Monday, judge set bail at $750,000 for the suspect, who was allegedly speeding and driving under the influence when he struck Anahi Mendoza. Police said the driver then fled the scene but was located and arrested a short time later. Mendoza died at the scene. During the Monday court hearing, Fox 13 reports prosecutors revealed that the suspect has a sprawling criminal record spanning multiple states. In Washington alone, 17 felony convictions, including vehicular assault, multiple accounts of attempting to elude law enforcement, theft, and attempted assault. Prosecutors say he has not gone approximately more than 2 years without being arrested on new charges since 1989. As you can imagine, Mendoza's family is ticked off and wondering why, despite all of these felony convictions, the suspect never spent more than, you know, a year behind bars for any of these crimes. Jennifer Newstead, who is Mendoza's aunt, said, "I don't understand how he was let out time and time and time again. We need to change the policies in this state with this catch and release. You hear about these things in the news. You don't think it's going to be you, but this could have been avoided." Yeah, it could have been. But the problem is that in Washington State, you do have a philosophy, I think, that starts at the state capitol, certainly in place at City Hall in Seattle, which is the, you know, the population center and the center of power politically in Washington State. And that philosophy wants to make excuses for violent criminals. They don't want to provide consequences. Now, you can look at what's going on. I think it's Aurora Avenue in Seattle, place where prostitution and drug dealing has been endemic for some time. And the excuses that the city has offered is that, well, you know, it's really tough to make these sex trafficking cases, to try to get these pimps off the street and charge them with felonies. I mean, that's really hard to do. So instead, what they're going to do, this was from the city attorney, they're going to try to use the Washington's red flag law to disarm these sex traffickers. Which is weird, because law enforcement has to be the one to file for a red flag order. In order to do that, you have to show that there's a, you know, reasonable belief that this individual in question poses a danger to themselves or others with a firearm. And you think if the police have done all that legwork, they could go ahead and arrest the sex trafficker for sex trafficking, right? I mean, again, this is not an isolated incident in Seattle that we're talking about today. This is endemic. And this is the result, I think, in large part of this soft-on-crime attitude that has infected the centers of power in Washington State. And sadly, I think we're going to see more cases like this going forward. Now on to today's Armed Citizen story from Venice, Florida, where an intruder was shot and killed at an apartment, had a history of threats and conflict with the apartment dweller, according to police. This happened a couple of days ago. I guess this was last week, last Wednesday morning. Detectives say that 32-year-old Terry Murphy, and a resident of the Marin Apartments and Townhomes, were engaged in a conflict before the incident. Interviews and a review of physical evidence, along with 911 recordings and video footage captured inside the home, led detectives to determine that Murphy forced himself into the apartment unit after the resident answered a knock at the door. Murphy allegedly got onto the complex property by jumping over a perimeter fence. The resident tried to stop Murphy from getting inside, but he was unable to do so. Murphy then assaulted the resident, threatened to shoot him while keeping one hand behind his back, in a way that led the resident to believe that Murphy was armed. Investigators say they believe that Murphy was trying to get the resident to leave the apartment against his will, noting that evidence indicates the two had prior conflicts. The resident also told police that Murphy had threatened him in the past. During this confrontation, the resident was able to grab a firearm from a bedroom in his apartment. That sparked a struggle over the gun until it discharged and struck Murphy, who then fled the apartment, managed to get inside another apartment two floors below. The resident apparently left that door unlocked. Investigators said that just a couple of moments later, the resident found Murphy injured inside his apartment, called 911. The resident who shot Murphy had also called 911. Murphy collapsed in the second apartment, was later pronounced dead. Detectives with the Venice Police Department say the investigation continues, but at this point, again, looks to be a justifiable act of self-defense. Somebody breaks into your apartment. You've got a, even if you don't have a history of conflict, they break in, they begin assaulting you. You have the right to defend yourself at that point. So we'll keep our eyes open for any more details as they become available, if any more details become available. And finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A good Samaritan in South Carolina who helped a couple of teens escape a burning vehicle said he'd do it 1,000 times over. Hopefully he doesn't have to do that anymore in his life. Alberto Ortega saw this three-vehicle crash last Friday, about 8:15 in the morning, on the Isle of Palms connector. Investigators say a 16-year-old driving a Ford F-150 crossed the double yellow line, collided head-on with an oncoming vehicle. Then a third driver swerved into the barrier in an attempt to avoid the crash. One of the vehicles then rolled over on its side, caught fire, trapping those inside. Ortega was on his way to work. He saw the crash happen. He said, in my mind, it happened like a movie. It was astonishing. He said, for a moment, I had to stop the car to see what the situation was and what was really happening. And he said, as soon as I stepped out of the car, I ran to the car that the lady was in. It was like a quick movie, and at first I didn't know what to do. He tried to break the truck's windows to free the trapped teenagers before first responders arrived. At first, he was by himself, but he said that other Good Samaritans quickly joined in. He said it was more of a community effort. He said, at the moment, I thought I was the only one there, but everything happened so quickly, other people started to come help. And he said, I'm very thankful because they risked a lot. Several people tried to smash the vehicle's windows, but they couldn't break in. He said, I got the idea to climb on top of the driver's door. Another driver involved in the crash ended up using tow straps to stabilize the burning vehicle and prevent it from shifting while there was a driver trapped inside. Firefighters later extricated the trapped driver before EMS transported three people to the hospital. Ortega was injured himself in this. He said, when I climbed on top of the car to get one of the boys out, the fire was getting stronger. He said, when one of the teens got out, I tried to jump out of the car, but my foot got stuck. He said, I was scared. He said, but I was able to pull my foot out and jump. He said, at the moment of the accident, I was losing a lot of blood. He said, the kids were taken in the ambulance, and I ended up driving myself to the nearest hospital. Thankfully, after receiving some stitches, Ortega is on the mend. And he told ABC4 in South Carolina that helping those trapped inside the vehicle was never a question. He said, I think life doesn't have a price. He said, I still think every person in my situation would do the same. We really should help people who are in need or in a moment of danger. He said also that he doesn't think the situation wasn't a coincidence. He said, I also think that God put me on that path. And he said that the families of the teenagers have reached out to him to thank him for his actions. And he said, I thank God that I was there in that moment. And I'm sure that the family does as well. According to the Mount Pleasant Police, teenage driver of the Ford F-150 cited for a reckless driving. It does not look like there are any fatalities in this wreck, which is astonishing. And again, I think that is in large part to the actions of Alberto Ortega and the other Good Samaritans who helped ensure that those teens could flee and escape that burning vehicle before first responders arrived. So in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing, Alberto Ortega and the other anonymous Good Samaritans there in Isle of Palms, South Carolina. We thank you for your very, very good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. And I want to thank you, as always, for being a part of the program. I'm looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. We will continue the conversation with ATF Director Robert Cicada and ATF Chief Counsel Robert Leiter. Be sure to check that out. But also be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the rest of the day today, keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. And if you like what you see, I would encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum member. Just go to BarryandArms.com/subscribe and use the promo code FIGHT to take 60% off your membership. No matter what tier of support you choose, you'll be supporting the work we're doing at Barry and Arms. Every tier, obviously, is a different and better benefits the higher up the ladder you go. But again, no matter what tier of support you choose, you'll be getting some great bennies and you'll be supporting the work we're doing at Barry and Arms. And that is, I'm so grateful for all of your support. So thank you for that. Enjoy the rest of your Hump Day Wednesday. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, be free.